Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today, and we're lucky to have her to discuss cardiology and women's heart health, is Dr. Kim Poley of Albany Medical Center's Cardiology Group. Dr. Poley is a non-invasive cardiologist with special interest in preventive care and treating women with heart disease. In addition to seeing patients, Dr. Poley reads echocardiograms and performs stress tests. A graduate of the University of Massachusetts Healthcare Center in Worcester, Dr. Poley completed her fellowship in cardiovascular disease at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston and is duly board certified in internal medicine and cardiology. Dr. Poley, what a pleasure. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, that's great. To participate in today's discussion, call 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be, every phone is going to be lit in about 3 seconds here. And so if you want to get in and ask your question, trust me, I'm from the government. Just pick up the phone, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Poley, or can I call you Kim?
Yeah, absolutely. That'd
be okay. Kim, let me ask you this. What's different about women's heart issues than men's? That's a good question.
That's a very good question. There's various things that are different. I'd say the number one thing is that women can present very differently than men with respect to acute coronary syndromes or when women are having problems with poor blood flow to their heart muscle. So in general, the more classic presentation is when people present with chest pain, radiating to the left arm.
So is that more men?
That's more men. Okay. Now, a lot of women may present like that too, but you have to be very careful about missing. A lot of women may present with just shortness of breath, abdominal pain, nausea, those kind of things.
Abdominal pain, really?
Abdominal, more epi.
Down in the tummy?
Yeah, yeah. They can have, and especially diabetics can also present that way.
Mm-hmm.
But they usually also have more subtle symptoms like nausea. They may have shortness of breath or just decreased exercise tolerance. So you just have to have a heightened awareness, I think, in women in general.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the phones are ringing, and as soon as we get the notification from the front about who's on the phones, we'll ask you their questions. And in fact, four phones are now ringing out of the potential of five. I knew that was going to happen. People who want to get on should get on right this second. Okay, so my second question, all five phones are now ringing. Okay, so let me ask you this. If a lot of people are now talking about statins and the side effects of statins, you know, muscle pain, this kind of thing. Do we know for sure that statins help?
Absolutely. We know as far as in secondary prevention, first of all, that people who've had a heart attack, people who have coronary disease, that if they take a statin, that their risk of having a recurrent heart attack is significantly reduced and their risk of having restenosis or a blockage again in those arteries is much reduced.
Now, we know, Kim, don't we, that because you're a student of the famous Framingham study in Framingham, Mass., which has been going on for 2,000 years. No, how long?
Since 1938.
Something like that. So this is where we get this kind of information from,
or
right?
48. Yes, it is. Absolutely. And that, you know, was a long study looking at, you know, people who just the regular population and their risk factors and following them forward in time to see who developed heart disease. And clearly those people who had high cholesterol had a higher risk of developing coronary artery disease. I think in general there are clearly symptoms that can develop from statins, but we in general they're also very common symptoms that can also be
muscle pain.
Exactly, muscle pain. I mean, a lot of people have muscle pains, but often, you know, if they're taking a statin, they automatically attribute it to that.
Now, there's another class of drug called Zetia. Well, it's not the class, but it's the brand name.
Yeah.
But it operates differently than the statins, right?
Yes, azetamib. And so that does, and it also hasn't been proven to decrease risk of myocardial infarctions or heart attacks. Even though it does lower the cholesterol, it does not.
It brings the number down, your
it does.
Cholesterol numbers, but we don't think it
we
does.
But we don't have the information yet on whether or not
right.
It actually lowers your risk of heart attack.
Okay, so let's go to phone number too, and I believe it's, my eyes aren't that good. Is it Monty? Hello?
Hi, Mary in Poughkeepsie.
Oh, Mary. Okay, yep. And I know our wonderful intern who's doing the intake is going to write in much bigger letters now. Okay, Mary, go ahead.
Okay. I have a question about Vicodin and hydrocodone long-term use. I've had a lumbar back problem for 10 years from some accidents I've had. Not my fault. Somebody hit me. And I've had to take this for pain, and I have a small mitral valve, you know, where the blood backs up, and it's become an issue for me only because my chest has started to develop pain, and I don't have a good cardiologist or one that I see very regularly. I've seen somebody, but they don't seem to pay much attention to my, you know, my entire history. So I'm wondering if I should be concerned about that Vicodin or hydrocodone doing something to me, because there don't seem to be any long-term studies on it. Is there anything I can hang on to here?
Well, as far as the Vicodin and the hydrocodone, that's, you know, that's a separate issue. As it sounds like you've used that to treat your back pain from a, you know, from a cardiologist's perspective, the chest pain is certainly concerning. I don't think that the Vicodin or the hydrocodone is causing your chest pain, and I don't. It could certainly mask chest pain that could be related to heart disease. So, I think the important thing would be to see your primary or see a cardiologist to have an evaluation and risk stratification to see if you are at risk.
And what would they do? What would Mary do in order to? What tests would they do on her help her out here?
Well, if she's having, they first take a good history, so, you know, and find out more about the chest pain, if it's exertional, if it's happening more at rest, and then her other risk factors. And then if it's if there's concern regarding the chest pain being a cardiac etiology, then usually they do a stress test, and it may be one of many different types of stress tests. It depends. In women, regular stress tests, you have more commonly false positive EKG changes, so they're not as accurate at predicting heart disease.
Is that right?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
So often, yes, women have to a nuclear stress test where you have imaging or echo.
Nuclear, where they put something in your blood.
Blood, or a stress echocardiogram where they check an echo at peak exercise so they can see the wall motion. Those can be helpful in women.
They said there was something in my stress test. He did do one. And he said that an echocardiogram with it or whatever, and it was an inverted image. He said that you look in an inverted image. He showed me where it was doing a slower than normal, whatever, a beat per hour. You know, it was just different. But he didn't seem too upset about it. And I'm kind of wondering what to do about it, because I have to go for surgery soon for my back, and I don't want to be caught with a problem that I'm not aware of.
Well, usually before a major surgery, too, your primary will evaluate you, and then if there's a concern about heart problems, you know, refer you to a cardiologist. And certainly, if you're concerned and you don't feel like you've had an adequate evaluation, I always encourage a second opinion. You know, you need to have your answers. You need answers, but it's hard to know without further details on what they actually saw.
Right. Now, Mary, I wish we could give you more time. We cannot. There's a huge backup on the Long Island Expressway here. And
would you just at least, before the show's over, could you mention some hospitals that might do, like, team efforts at heart analysis for women? I mean, like Johns Hopkins or, you know, I don't know, places in Minnesota, Rochester maybe, or anywhere.
Okay, very quickly then, Mary. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Yes, there are. Well, currently at Albany Medical Center, we're trying to establish something similar to that. Right now, there is certainly active programs in, you know, Boston and New York City, you know, at Brigham and Women's, also at Mass General Hospital. They have women in preventative health programs. But I think, again, you need to see a cardiologist, and perhaps you want to see, you know, if you didn't feel you had a adequate analysis, ask to see a female if you think that you might be more comfortable with a female,
okay,
or you think they might listen more.
Mary, thanks for the call.
And you're in Worcester, right? I know Worcester.
No.
Okay.
No, you're here, aren't you?
Yeah, I am here. I trained in Worcester.
Oh, I see. Yes.
No.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Mary.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's go to Lewis in Woodstock. Okay, Lewis, we're running up against a little bit of a post here. Go ahead.
Hello, Lewis from Woodstock. Hey, Alan.
Hey.
Listen, guys, I understand that there's a particular kind of boot, a pressure boot therapy that cardiologists use several times a week. I don't know how many, an hour, 2 hours at a time. And it has some kind of pulsing air pressure in it. And it helps the heart rebuild or build new blood vessels.
Okay, here we go. Go ahead, Mary. Kim. Kim, yeah, Lewis.
Yes, that's something done in a cardiologist's office, and only certain ones actually offer that. And it used to be... It used to be, certainly in Boston, it was offered. I don't believe we have that available here, and it's questionable. That's specifically used also in people who have severe coronary artery disease who are trying to build kind of bypasses of their own. You don't want to go right to that. I mean, first you need to be evaluated if you have heart disease and be on the right, preventative therapy with regard to medication, and also, it depends on the degree of poor blood flow that you have to your heart. So it's very specific patients who are, who would be good candidates for that, and you don't want to have peripheral vascular disease.
So. Okay, Lewis, I'm so sorry. We got to stop here.
Do you know what it's called? It's a therapy. What's that therapy called?
Yeah, I know. I'm drawing a blank, and I can certainly come back to that
if you remember.
If I remember.
Lewis, always great to hear from you. Thanks for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany. Identity Eyewear, it's what sets you apart. EYEdentityeyewear.net. The Blue Bonnet Diner, Northampton, since 1950, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner, banquet facilities, seating 150, banquet menus, bar services, and dance floor, bluebonnetdiner.net. Berkshire Classic Leather and Silver, Lennox, featuring travelwear luggage by Briggs & Riley, silver jewelry, leather jackets and coats, and accessories by Brighton, 413-637-0727. And The Linda, presenting the poetry, music, and spoken word of Urban Guerrilla Theater, Friday, July 20th at 9 p.m., thelinda.org.
Hi, everybody. We're back, and our wonderful cardiologist, Dr. Kim Poley of the Albany Medical Center's Cardiology Group, is with us. And here we go. Let's go to Katie. All right, Katie and Medusa. Katie, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm 66 years old. About 2.5 years ago, I was put into the cardiac unit overnight because I had tachycardia and irregular heartbeat. I was drinking a lot of caffeine then. I totally cut out the caffeine. I've lost 80 pounds. I walk a couple of miles a day. I'm kayaking now. My blood pressures now are about 102 over 60, and I was taking Verapamil 240 milligrams extended release. He dropped that to 80 twice a day, and I'm still on Metoprolol 25 milligrams twice a day.
Katie, what's the question?
Okay, my question is, with all the fitness I've been doing and losing weight, is it ever possible to totally get off these meds?
Certainly, there are instances where people can decrease their medications or even get off the medication. It depends on what the arrhythmia, what the problem was actually at the time. You had a tachycardia or an irregular heartbeat.
Tachycardia is, just for the rest of us, a fast heartbeat.
Yes.
And he had said at the time that a lot of it was related to drinking too much coffee, which dehydrated me.
Uh-huh. So there's sinus tachycardia, which is just a regular heartbeat that goes fast, like when you're running.
Uh-huh.
But then then some people, if you drink a lot of caffeine or certainly alcohol, that can contribute to something called atrial fibrillation, which is a whole different type of arrhythmia, and that could increase, you know, risk of stroke. And
I did not have that.
So often it sounds like you've done amazing, first of all, with regard to your lifestyle modifications. And certainly when people do make significant changes like you have in weight loss and the exercise, often their medications can be titrated down. But it depends, you know, on a lot of factors, including what, what the arrhythmia was, what if you had any evidence of structural heart disease at the time, which I'm sure they would have evaluated with an echocardiogram or something.
All right.
But it's certainly possible. I would ask your doctor, and they can, if you haven't seen a cardiologist recently, certainly see them and review it, and it's possible that it could be reduced.
Kim, okay. I'm just puzzled by one word, titrated down. What is
titrated? I'm sorry, no. Decreasing, tapering the dose down. You don't ever want to stop. The two medications she's on, verapamil and metoprolol, they both work by lowering the heart rate. Mm-hmm. So if you suddenly stop them, you can have a reflexed increase in the heart rate. Mm. So you don't want to just stop them suddenly. But it sounds like you're on two medications that do the same thing but in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible that you may only need one, or that, you know, if you did not have an arrhythmia, if you just had a fast heart rate because of dehydration from caffeine, then certainly that I would think that would be able to be decreased, your medication.
So I should contact him and maybe go through having the echocardiogram and stress test again.
I would contact, if it's the same doctor, he could even, you know, he or she could review things and see what other tests, whether you need further testing before titrating it down, or if you've been stable, they might do that without any further testing.
Yeah.
They have more of your background history, which I would need.
Katie, okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Molly in Saugerties. Molly, you're on.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi. My mother is 90, and she has a heart condition that's not real serious, but she started having also a little pain in her shoulder and her neck about a year ago, and the doctor put her on oxycodone. And now she's experiencing loss of appetite in a very bad way, but she, of course, can't have salt, so part of her problem is the salt-free diet, but it's just gotten worse and worse. I guess I'm wondering about the long-term effects of oxycodone use in the older people.
Well, I'm mostly practicing in cardiology, and I would refer you back to the primary to discuss that. I mean, certainly it has there is addiction potential. I'd be more concerned in your mom if she's had weight loss, that it may or may not be related to the oxycodone, and I'd be wondering about other things such as is there an underlying malignancy or cancer or other diseases or depression, other things that could be causing her loss of appetite. But she would have to be, you know, certainly evaluated by a doctor too.
Well, is the oxycodone a dangerous drug?
It certainly is a dangerous and addictive drug.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's not something usually you would, and in older people, they're always more sensitive to medications. And I'm not sure what her issue was that made them put her on oxycodone, but certainly for a 90-year-old woman, it can be very strong and has a lot of side effects.
Molly, thank you for the call. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Right. Let's go to Lee in Ulster. 1-800-348-2551. You're on, Lee.
Hi.
Hey.
I have a specific question about myself. Post-menopause, I have this problem in the heat where my face gets beet red. Now, I was told that that was actually that I should see a doctor about it because there was a heart condition of which that was a symptom. And I was calling to ask if that, in fact, is the case.
Hmm.
I mean, I get really, my face gets beet red. It's extremely uncomfortable.
Does that also happen if you're, like, anxious or stressed?
Only the heat.
Only
just
the heat.
I mean, I'm a little heat sensitive. I've always been. I don't like the heat.
Yeah.
But this is something that's only occurred since, again, postmenopause, and worse as I get older.
You can, I don't know what specifically they're talking about with respect to heart disease. Usually when you do get that redness in the face, Some people also, that happens too in the heat or when they're drinking alcohol, and it's because of vasodilatation or an enlargement of the blood superficial blood vessels. So the blood flow increases to the face and causes that redness. I don't know if that's what they're referring to. I don't know if, really specifically what you were, what the person was concerned about.
I have serious pain in the calves, which I'm told is PVD. Would that in any way relate to it?
What's CVD?
Peripheral vascular disease.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So is that what you mean? You have,
yeah. Sorry.
So she has narrowing in the arteries to her feet and to her lower extremities. That would not be related to the flushing or the redness in your face. I mean, certainly postmenopausal women get a lot of flushing and that redness in the heat, and they're very heat intolerant, so it could be related to that.
Are you on any meds?
No, I take nothing. I mean, I don't even take aspirin. You know, my big indulgence is a cup of coffee every morning.
I mean, is this something that's been like this your whole life?
No. I mean, I've never liked the heat, but this is postmenopause.
Oh, okay.
And I say in the last 5 or 6 years.
So, again...
I mean, I don't get a lot of exercise anymore, and I thought that might have something to do with it. But this is really a big symptom. It gets hot, and I get, like, fire engine red. It's enough for people to be concerned about me if they see it.
Have you had your blood pressure checked during one of those episodes?
Normal. As far as I've never had high blood pressure, never had cholesterol, never had anything.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I think certainly, you know, flushing is very common in postmenopausal women, and the redness that you get, again, because of the, you know, increase in capillaries to the face and the increase in blood flow.
But not a cardiac.
But nothing that I can think, it just has nothing to do with coronary artery disease or, congestive heart failure per se, anything that I can put my hands on, no.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, and I appreciate your time.
Hey, Lee, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Yep. Let's go to Martha in Great Barrington. Martha, you're on with Dr. Poley.
Hi. I heard a conversation recently from a lipidologist who suggested that in most primary care offices, when they're doing traditional lipid profiles, that even people with normal good cholesterols and good triglycerides can still have significant coronary artery disease, and that the appropriate blood work should really be something called an LDL little p, and that you should also consider having an ultrasound done of your carotid artery. So I wanted to hear your comments on that.
There's certainly many people who have heart disease who have normal cholesterol. The Jupiter trial, which is a trial done recently, which had showed people with normal cholesterol, but a high C-reactive protein, which is a marker of inflammation in the blood, those people, there's a significant amount of those people who are at risk for, you know, have coronary artery disease. So even if there's certain different blood tests you can check, if including a lipid particle size and cardiac C-reactive protein that are markers that can further identify the people at risk. But that's so if you have traditional risk factors, that isn't necessary. But certainly if you're someone who has a family history and no history of hyperlipidemia, no hypertension or other risk factors that would explain things, then LDL particle size or ApoB, other lipoproteins can be measured, and if they're elevated, those are a marker of heart disease. So just having a totally normal lipid profile where you have a total cholesterol and your LDL or the typical bad cholesterol doesn't mean you're out of the woods.
Now for the world, what is a lipid?
So the fat buildup in the blood, you know, your heart, your body normally makes cholesterol, and it's broken down into different types of fat in your blood. So the bottom line is that your cholesterol, we need some cholesterol, and that fat deposit that occurs in the arteries, it builds up over time and contributes to, you know, like rupture of the plaque. So as far as the cholesterol itself, it's essentially a fat or a plaque, and then there's other types. When we do your lipid profile, your triglycerides, and your LDL, and those, your low-density lipoprotein, those are different types of cholesterol in your body. Your high-density lipoprotein, the higher your HDL is, the potentially more protective that is. That's your good cholesterol,
good
your
cholesterol.
HDL. Mm-hmm. The LDL is your bad one, but that can also be broken down into particle size, which this woman was bringing up.
The lipidologist
had brought up, and your LDL particle size can also be a marker. So if you have a normal LDL but you have a small particle size, then you can be at increased risk for heart disease.
Huh. Well, Martha, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are excellent. Let's go to whoever in Massachusetts. Who are you?
You mean me?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Nick Thompson.
Nick, okay, Nick, go.
I have the answer to the mystery therapy with the boot.
Oh, thank you.
Which is enhanced external
counterpropulsion
therapy, EECP.
Thank you, yes.
And I have a question. Mm-hmm. It's been strongly recommended to me by two doctors in Santa Fe and strongly unrecommended to me by a doctor in Boston. And they were both recommendations are general, that is it generally a good thing or is it generally a bad thing? I wonder your opinion as to whether it's safe and effective.
You know, where I trained in Boston, they did do EECP. And thank you for helping with my memory there. But as far as the treatment, again, like I was mentioning before, it depends on very specific people. It can be very helpful. So people who have severe coronary disease, have had surgery, but have recurrence of the disease, and where they're already on maximal medical therapy, then it can help with respect to decreasing your symptoms, and potentially can improve. Help you to build small bypasses, but it hasn't been shown, as far as I'm aware, to lower your risk of like having another heart attack or of decreasing your mortality related to heart disease. So part of the issue is depends on what your. Have you had a heart attack before?
I've had no heart attack. I've had a carotid artectomy, and I have mild exertional angina.
And what are you on? Any medications?
Yes, the usual medications.
Are you on a beta blocker? Like
yes.
Metoprolol and aspirin?
Yes.
A statin?
Statin, yes.
Okay. An ACE inhibitor like lisinopril or Zestril, something like that?
Sorry, now I'm beginning to get mixed up.
That's okay. But the bottom line, it sounds like you are on the basic, medications that you would treat angina with. And the EECP, it may improve your symptoms, but if you're not on maximal medical therapy, my first recommendation would be, depending on your blood pressure and heart rate, your medications could be increased, like the beta blocker. There are other medicines that dilate the arteries that help improve the blood flow, that are less time consuming, less, as far as...
Is it a fad? I mean, I get the feeling that the people out in Santa Fe, they talk about it as if it's life transforming.
Really? It was very, it was in the beginning of it during my training, which is late 1990s then in Boston, that was a newer therapy. But right now it's not life. I would not say that it's life transforming. Like I said, it doesn't change your mortality risk. So unlike a beta blocker or statin therapy, which have been proven to lower your risk of a recurrent heart attack or, your first heart attack. So those would be more important.
Nate, thank you very much for calling. And I know our wonderful phone answerers are going to write in big block letters. Thanks again. And we will take a short break and we will be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Glens Falls Hospital, Big City Medicine, Hometown Care, 29 locations in the North Country and Saratoga regions, glensfallshospital.org. Molly Cantor Pottery, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, presenting Back to the Garden, a group show of pottery and sculpture about the garden through August 31st. Reception August 4th, mollypots.com. Springbrook, Oneonta, New York, supporting people of all ages with developmental disabilities, working in schools and homes and in communities across across New York to help individuals achieve independence. SpringbrookNY.org. And New England Hydroponics on Route 10 in Southampton, Massachusetts, helping people bring plants to life since 2002, offering hydroponic supplies and indoor lining for plants. NEHydro.com.
And we are back with Dr. Poli, and she is, your chances of getting in right now are excellent. I mean excellent. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, so Kim, I guess my next question is, how dangerous are stress tests? I remember I have a very good friend who got on a stress test one day. The nurse came in and said, "I hope what happened to the last guy doesn't happen to you." And then that person said, "What happened?" And the answer was, "He died." And now then the nurse came back and apologized for having done that. But I was wondering whether or not it is a serious, whether or not you can hurt yourself on a test like that. On a treadmill.
Yes, people can certainly die on a treadmill or from a stress on a stress test, but that's only if you have underlying, you know,
sure.
severe coronary.
Well, that's what they're testing for, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So usually, though, that's why you want to see a doctor beforehand to decide whether, first of all, is it, you know, just by the history, does the patient sound like they have severe coronary artery disease and are at high risk? Then you would, if someone's having exertional chest pain and they're having it and it's increasing daily or something, a patient like that, you don't want to put on the treadmill, or if they're having rest pain that you with changes on the electrocardiogram. So there's basic screening tests you do before you even send a patient to a, you know, to get a stress test.
So you just mentioned the idea that in order to get even more definitive results, sometimes there's an injection, you know, of a dye. Does that have risk?
The dye, it's a radionuclide that does give you, there is a dose of radiation that's about equivalent to a chest x-ray. So certainly, you know, it's not the kind of test you want to have, you know, multiple times a year.
Right.
And it wouldn't be helpful in that manner. But aside from the cumulative risk from radiation,
No. And how about that cumulative risk from radiation? What would you say about that?
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, over a lifetime, if you were having, you know, like I said, multiple stress tests a year, but you shouldn't be having, that occur. If you're having one nuclear stress test even a year or every other year or every few years, that is not significant.
Well, now I exercise an hour every day. It is a fairly aerobic exercise. And I once had a doc say to me, he wanted to put me on a stress test. I said, well, you know, I exercise every day. And he said, well, yeah, if you had a real problem, you'd probably be dead. So I wonder about that. Let's go. Our interns are really improving. Let's go to Linda in Albany, New York. Linda, you're on.
Hi, doctor. I've been told that my B12 levels are low, and that they may have been low for quite some time. And I have had irregular heartbeats with throwing what they call PVCs. And I've been getting more chest pain. I'm 57. I have been evaluated about 5 years ago now with a cardiac cath because I sort of failed my stress test. It came back benign PVCs. But I was wondering, with this B12 level being low, what is your take on that being a potential problem with cardiac events?
Yeah, I don't think that is contributing at all to your chest pain or to your PVCs. Those are premature ventricular contractions for the audience who isn't aware. But
yeah, a lot of people get them and they get very worried because they take their blood, you know, they put their hand on their
Feel an irregular pulse.
And and it turns out that, you know, those aren't really terribly important.
Right, exactly. A lot of people have them and don't even know it. If low vitamin B12 certainly can contribute to like a neuropathy or difficulty feeling in your hands and toes and that kind of thing. And so it's certainly something you want to replete if it is low and kind of long-term effects. But from a heart standpoint, no, I don't think that's your problem.
That's interesting because last week we had the foot guy in, and a lot of people were calling about neuropathies, like feeling that they had socks between their, you know, their toes. But we never heard about vitamin B12.
Yes, vitamin B12 deficiency is certainly...
Well, at least I don't think we did. Linda, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
That's okay. No, that you answered my question. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda. Good luck to you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Let's go to another Linda in Troy, New York. Okay, Linda in Troy.
Yes, hi. My question is about the connection between rheumatoid arthritis and heart disease. Had rheumatoid arthritis for about 17 years. Trying to do as much as I can in terms of eating right, exercising. I have had a carotid artery scan. That was all right. But some of my meds raise my cholesterol level, and I'm being monitored by a rheumatologist. But I just was wondering if there was anything else, you know, sort of proactively that I can do to keep heart disease at bay.
Do you have any other risk factors for heart disease, like high blood pressure, high cholesterol?
Cholesterol high, but that's being monitored. They think it's because of the medication I'm taking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not on any statins right now.
And your family history? Do you have a family history of premature heart disease? So
yeah, grandfather died at 52. That's kind of worrisome. Uncle died of a heart attack, you know, so a little worrisome there.
Mm-hmm. As far as different screening methods, if you're not having any symptoms,
mm-hmm.
part of the thing when you see a doctor is they'll usually ask your activity level, because
mm-hmm.
if you're not active, then it's very, then we can underestimate a person's risk for heart disease. In that case, a stress test can be very helpful, because if you're not able to walk on a treadmill, there's different types of pharmacologic stress tests we can do to risk stratify you. With respect to rheumatoid arthritis, though, there is, you know, increased inflammation in the blood, and I started to mention before about cardiac C-reactive protein, and we certainly know that people with, you know, increased inflammation, that is one of the factors that contributes toward accelerated atherosclerosis. So
mm-hmm.
Putting you at risk. So I would say that depending, if you have multiple risk factors, you have certainly some family history there, high cholesterol, even if it's related to the medication, and that, you know, a statin might be helpful in you. But again, you need to go over all those things with your doctor to see if that would be something reasonable. Or if you haven't had a recent stress test or not very active. Do you do any exercise? Are you able to get around with the rheumatoid arthritis?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. You wouldn't know I have it to look at me. I mean, I'm young for my, I look young for my age. I'm very active. I'm sort of a petite person anyway. Try to stay active, eat right, walk
right.
all the time. No, I'm on it.
Yeah.
It's just that I was thinking, is there anything else I can do? Even, vitamins or,
right.
obviously, I take a one a day, all that stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Anything kind of else.
Right. Well, two things. The carotid ultrasound a woman earlier had brought up too, and I hadn't brought up, but it can assess the intimal thickness, so the evidence of plaque buildup in your carotid arteries, which is also
mm-hmm.
a marker for disease in your coronary arteries.
Mm-hmm.
That can be done, but again, usually there's, with medicine these days, you need a reason to do it. So if you're not having symptoms, or if a doctor, if they have a high suspicion, or if they hear a bruit on exam, an abnormality on exam, then they might order something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or any risk if you've had evidence of a stroke, or even minor sudden loss of vision, things like that. But otherwise, things that you can do, vitamins, unfortunately, there's been many studies done over the years, both retrospective, prospective, and they have not proven to be a benefit. So, vitamin E, vitamin C from heart disease. So with respect
mm-hmm.
to heart disease, you can take a multivitamin, but, if you're eating a well-rounded diet with, fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, taking a multivitamin is not going to lower
your
risk
fish
of
oil?
Heart disease. Fish oil actually is a good point. So mm-hmm. fish oil, it can be beneficial, certainly. It has omega-3, so that's a certain type of beneficial fat. So it's not the saturated
yeah.
fat, but
okay, yeah, it sounds like I'm doing it, yeah. I mean, I eat salmon, the whole bit.
I try to
nutritionally stay on top of all that. But,
yeah.
All right, well, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing, I guess.
All right, Linda from Troy, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much.
Okay, let's go to Selma from Salem. That's alliteration, Selma from Salem. I learned that in English class. It's the only thing I remember. Go ahead, Selma.
Dr. Foley, I wondered about this new Medicare thing when one needs a catheterization, and you have to have a you have to have a catheterization first and then a second catheterization before you actually get the stent. I've had a heart bypass and a stent, and I have one artery that's showing that it's closing up, so I'm going to need at some time, another stent. but I don't want to have another two catheterizations to put one stent in. And that seems to be Medicare's way now.
Okay, in other words, you need a catheterization to discover whether you need the stent, is what you're saying.
Right.
Well, that's what, I mean, the catheterization is the diagnostic part that's done, you know, at the same, these days, it's usually done most of the time at the same time as the stent. So you do the catheterization as
well. Oh, yes. That's how I've had it done before, but I've been told now that you have to have the catheterization and then come back and have it to get the stent.
You know, it depends. I don't know with respect to, I have not heard of that as being a, I have not had that problem in treating my population patient, which includes Medicare patients. But the other, you know, certain patients, we do have them come back on a different day. If you have, you know, if it's not clear cut what artery needs to be done and it needs to be discussed with the, you know, interventional doctor, or if you have kidney disease, you know, there are different factors in which having the stent on a separate day would be beneficial for you. I don't, but as that being a general rule with Medicare patients, I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Yeah, well, it seems to be, I've called Medicare and my doctor that I'm seeing now, but I kind of like the idea of seeing a woman cardiologist, so I can try to find you in the phone book and maybe I can.
Okay, and remember, Dr. Poli, it's Dr. Kim Poli, P-O-L-I, and she's at Albany Med, and so that's the way to find her. Thank you, Silva.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
1-800-348-2551. We're rounding the turn now, but we got some time here. So if you've got a call for Dr. Poli, we'd love you to pick up the phone and dial it. It may save your life, you know. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Carlos in Vermont. Carlos.
Hi, doctor. I just have a quick question for you. I suffered a heart attack several years back and was treated with a stent and the usual cardiovascular drugs, and then was for several years, one of the drugs I was on was metoprolol, which I'm now not taking. And I just wondered if you had any information or if you could comment about the effects of some of these beta blocker drugs on the brain, on thinking and so forth.
I mean, in general, beta blockers are very helpful with respect to coronary artery disease and lowering your risk of heart attack, also for blood pressure and treating, you know, so if people are at risk for stroke, which can certainly affect the brain if you're having strokes periodically, that can affect the brain. But from as far as cognition and things, you're thinking clearly. I mean, unless it's causing low blood pressure, I'm not aware of how that would affect your brain function.
Okay, well, I guess I'm an English major and know very little about science, but my understanding is that beta receptors are affected by beta blockers, and then once if one is on beta blockers for a significant period of time, possibly one's beta receptors do not return to their previous state, or they're in some ways permanently affected by the beta blocker medication.
No, with respect to, like, first of all, metoprolol is cardioselective, so it won't affect, unlike the older beta blockers that used to also affect the brain, they don't, that's why you don't see the same effects that you used to years ago in patients who were on medications that block their beta 1 and beta 2 receptors. But no, you know, it's not something where the receptors go away or become less reactive to the medication.
Well, thank you so much. That's
Carlos,
very good information to hear.
Thanks for the great call. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Doctor, you said just before, and I'll take the next call real quickly, you said you didn't find a brewy. What's a brewy?
Oh, a brewy is a sound that you hear in the neck, which is usually from turbulent blood flow, but it can be from a narrowing in the artery, so in the carotid artery. Although, you know, many people can have a severe narrowing. More than 50% of people can have a severe narrowing and not have a brewy. But if you hear it, that's certainly a reason to get a carotid ultrasound.
Gotcha. I thought it was a beer, but now I get it. Let's go to Laurie in South Hadley. Hi, Lori. How you doing?
Hi. I just wanted to. I just heard the lady speak about the PVCs, and mm-hmm. I had my first AFib in 2004, my second in 2007. The first one I came to fine was on medication. The second one I spent a few years with the PVCs, and they caused me to be very anxious, and I had panic attacks, and it was just very fearful. During this time, I had seen the movie on Temple Garden, and her anxiety, her panic attacks, the compression therapy, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. I found that through my asking about compression therapy, I found that I could crisscross my sweater at night in bed and put a little pressure on my chest, and I tell you, that calmed me down, and now for a few years, I've been fine. And I just wanted to ask you about that.
I say if it's helping and making you feel better and relaxing you, then I would certainly recommend it. I don't know of specifically what compression therapy you're referring to.
Well, I had called an autistic therapy group because they do use these on autistic children and adults. And it's just a compression on your chest. As a matter of fact, the University of Massachusetts now has and does sell a compression vest
mm-hmm.
for people with autism and people with anxiety problems.
The only time, yeah, so from we do, you know, in people who are after bypass surgery and stuff, we do something like that. We have people hold a pillow, you know,
right,
to their
yes.
chest and things. The bottom line is when you're having premature heartbeats,
right.
they can be very anxiety provoking, you know, because when you're normally we're not aware of our heart beating.
That's right.
And when you feel that, it can increase the catecholamines and things in your body and make
right.
your heart race. And then, you know, you get more concerned and then your blood
That's
pressure
right.
goes up. So part of it is doing whatever, you know, is helpful to relax you.
Right.
You know, yoga would be great, meditation, those kind of things. Biofeedback is another thing that can be very helpful. But if compression of holding something or putting a little pressure on your chest is helpful, absolutely.
Yes, it is very, I find. It's especially at night when you're in bed, trying to sleep. And
Lori, I don't want to interrupt because there
fine.
Are people behind you. But
doctor,
that raises an interesting question. I once said, you know, if people have muscle pain, you know, from overexertion or whatever, and they think they're having a heart attack. I once asked a doc, and I wondered if this is true. Does this mean, he said to me, if you're having a heart attack, touching the muscle is not going to, you know, in other words, if you're touching the muscle, it has to be sort of internal. That is not a signal of a heart attack.
Right. If you touch the muscle and causing your pain or exasperating, that is not a sign of a heart attack.
Great.
That's more muscular.
Okay, very quickly then, let's go to Drew. Okay, Drew, you're on.
Hey there.
Hey.
I'm 28 years old. When I was 20, I had a DVT. I had a blood clot in my subclavian vein. I had it treated with thrombolysis. It basically dissolved the clot in my shoulder, and I found out also that I'm heterozygous for factor V Leiden, the genetic clotting disorder.
Yes.
And since then, I've been taking low-dose Coumadin for the last 8 years, and I've been maintaining an INR between 1.5 and 2.0. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm planning on basically maintaining that treatment for the rest of my life because I haven't had any complications, I haven't had any bleeding or anything like that since then. And I'm wondering if you know of any studies that have been done about very long-term use of Coumadin and whether there are any other risks associated with it apart from the bleeding stuff.
No, I think that in your case, you're absolutely right. If you have a genetic abnormality causing the clotting disorder, that first of all, that puts you at increased risk for blood clot in your leg and to your lungs, and that could kill you. So you need to be on it long term. And there's certainly many young people who've been for various reasons, whether it be a mechanical heart valve or other things that they've required long term Coumadin. And no, aside from the bleeding risk, that's really the main thing.
And now Coumadin is a blood thinner, right? Is that the idea?
It is. It's a blood thinner.
And what's the risk with Coumadin?
Well, the risk is that you can, if you have other underlying problems, it can thin your blood too much. You can bleed. So if you have like even just a little inflammation in your stomach, then potentially, and your blood is thinned too much, it can make you bleed. Coumadin is a drug that needs to be monitored on a regular basis, because if you have too much of it, then it really increases
and
your risk.
And people with atrial fib do usually have Coumadin. Is that the idea?
Yes, Coumadin, or there are other newer medications now that are also used. But again, they all thin your blood to lower your risk of a clot going to your brain from stroke.
Okay. I thank you, Drew, for the question. Appreciate it very much. We're going to have to leave Leo on the line. Leo, I am so sorry. Next time. And that won't work. We're just out of time. Again, Leo, we're sorry. Dr. Kim Poley, wonderful having you with us today. You're great. Appreciate it. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-4767 for appointments. And from Woodland Pond at New Paltz, Life Care Retirement Living in the Mid-Hudson Valley, 256-5320. I also want to thank our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks for interns Emily Baker and Casey Schnackenberg for answering the phones today. They're doing terrific. Thanks again for listening. Stay tuned now for a news update.